Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. In this first part of Focus, we'll be talking with a man who, until fairly recently, was the leader of the premier university in Uganda, Makere University. Our guest is John Sifubu. He was for 10 years, from 1993 until just this past spring, the vice chancellor of the university. The Makere is the leading institution of higher education in Uganda. At one time, many people referred to it as the Harvard of Africa. Generally, that was in the 1960s. The university was founded in 1921. At that time, there were only 14 students. All of them were boys, and there were just 5 instructors. However, this past March, more than 3,700 students received diplomas, and more than 1,600 of them were women. The university numbers among its graduates some of East and Central Africa's leading figures in the world of politics and business and the arts. Our guest was born and educated in Uganda and also in Ireland, where he received his PhD from Queen's University in Belfast. He is a chemist by his academic training. And as vice chancellor, he was not only the chief academic officer of the university, he was also the chief administrative officer and the chief financial officer. So quite the burden there on the vice chancellor. During his time there at Makere, he was very active in expanding enrollment and modernizing the university that clearly had suffered through years of neglect and political upheaval, particularly in the 1970s and the 1980s. He is here visiting the campus. His visit is sponsored by the Mortensen Center for International Library Programs. This is a program that's now been around since 1991 that provides training for librarians from outside the United States, doing that by bringing them here to campus, in many cases by bringing them here to the campus of the university. Hundreds of them have come here from more than 80 countries around the country to attend seminars and subjects like library management and money raising, new technologies. He'll be giving the 14th annual Mortensen Distinguished Lecture, talking about his experiences managing an African university. That is today, 4 o'clock this afternoon on the U of I campus, room 126 at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science. And I'm certain that anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by and hear what he has to say. Questions here are welcome too as we talk. If there's some question you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, you can certainly do that here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people who are listening have questions, you're welcome to call. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be here.
It's always interesting for us to have people who come to the campus, particularly people who come from outside of the United States, because their perspective on things are different than ours, and that's a good thing to hear. You know, one of the things that I read was that for almost all of the history of the university, up until the time that your successor took over, the chancellor of the university was selected by the head of the government. It was a political appointment. And that the head of the government is perhaps in name only, is the head of the university.
That's right.
But then that person then selects the person who will be the head of the university, the chancellor.
Right. Yeah.
And as I say, the man who took over from you in March, this was the first time that the university itself had selected the chancellor.
Exactly.
Just how political was the position of vice chancellor in the university in the past when it was selected by whoever the head of the government was?
Surprisingly, on the part of the people who were selected, none of my predecessors had any strong political affiliation to the government of the day. Mm-hmm. But the position of the vice chancellor, who is the equivalent of the president in the American system, was under the control of the minister responsible for education, and of course the head of state, the president, who was automatically the titular head or the chancellor. Because in the Commonwealth system, every university has a titular head, a ceremonial person. And the person who is actually the chief executive officer becomes the vice to this titular head, so mm-hmm. the vice chancellor. And so since the head of state was the chancellor, naturally, the vice chancellor had to deputize for him on matters which concerned the university. And so, in a way, the politics was more on the government side than on the people who were occupying the position. Maybe this is because most of the people who were occupying these positions were seasoned academicians.
Hmm. So during the time that you were the chancellor, President Museveni did not in a direct way try to exercise any influence over university policy?
No, and that's the good thing about the current government. They gave us a lot of latitude to manage our own affairs. Naturally, the minister responsible for education had a lot of power and responsibility over the government. Mm-hmm. I think we were fortunate that we had people who were a bit forward-looking. I think they were tired of the excess control, which always resulted in a backlash. People at the university resented any direct interference, any direct some form of control, giving directives to do this or that. However, there were a few issues we had to consult. For instance, if we wanted to expand student enrollment, we had to have a green light from the minister responsible for education. But these were usually friendly exchanges. But in the past, yes, ministers wielded a lot of power and they could direct a few things to be done and they could fire and hire as they wished.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, certainly I would expect that you would be dependent upon the government for any of the funds that it would have taken to do things like build buildings and buy equipment and provide the infrastructure necessary to provide the education.
True. Up to about 1994, Makerere University, like most public universities in Africa, was totally dependent on the exchequer of Uganda for both recurrent and capital development expenditure. That, of course, put a lot of limitations on what we could do. First of all, the money coming from the treasury was dwindling. And therefore, we're chronically underfunded. The university was chronically underfunded, and that translated into a shortage of scholastic materials, both in the libraries and in the laboratories. The physical plant started decaying. You know, you could see the dilapidation. Students were not getting what they expected in the world of welfare, and so it was a recipe for a lot of strife. But the fact that the government was the only funder made it that much more difficult. Of course, once in a while you would get a donor to give you funds for research, a piece of research or something like that. But by and large, it was a government thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I know that, and I believe that here I'm thinking of a time going back to the 80s when there was a real push to rebuild and redevelop the university, that the university did receive a significant amount of money from the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, tens of millions of dollars, and then there was more money coming from the World Bank in the form of a loan. Today, how much of the money that it takes to operate the university comes from outside of Uganda?
Oh, it is still substantial. If I looked at the figures correctly, maybe up to 40% of our funding comes from external sources. Naturally, and we are very grateful to the people of the USA because USAID came in a big way, but they were very selective. They put most of the investment in the Faculty of Agriculture, and naturally so, because they wanted to make sure that we could help farmers produce food, enough food for us, not only in quantity but also in quality, that some of it could be exported. And so there was a big program called MUFAD, Manpower for Agricultural Development, which the USAID funded in terms of expertise. We had a lot of professors coming out from here, from different universities, coming to Makerere, doing a stint of somewhere up to 2 years or 3 years. We had a lot of equipment purchased. We had vehicles. We had all the experimental farms redone, and so on. And so that one was a big investment, and we're very grateful because they gave us a big foundation, a big push out of our difficulties. The Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation, these, as you know, are private institutions, have been with us since the 50s. When still the British government was controlling Uganda, which was amazing because at that time the Ford Foundation even gave the British government over $70,000 to put up a big building, a residential building at Makerere, which was unusual. I don't know how they pulled it off, but there it was. And up to now, they are still there, and they are continuing to give us funds. But these two don't provide funds for brick and mortar.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Focus 580, for anyone who might just recently have tuned in. We're speaking with Dr. John Sifubu. He is the former vice chancellor of Makerere University in Uganda, the leading institution of higher education in Uganda. He was the vice chancellor there for 10 years from 1993 until just this spring. And he's here visiting the campus to talk about some of his experiences managing an African university. He is going to be delivering this afternoon the 14th annual Mortensen Distinguished Lecture. His visits here sponsored by the Mortensen Center for International Library Programs. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You were, I believe I have this right, that in 1971, when Idi Amin came to power in the military coup there in Uganda, you were an undergraduate at Makerere?
I was just completing my first year as an undergrad. And it was quite an experience. We had heard rumors that there was a serious misunderstanding between the then president of Uganda, Milton Obote, and his army commander, who was then Idi Amin. There were some allegations that Idi Amin had been involved in smuggling gold and ivory from the Congo, which is our neighbor on the west. So the president wanted to discipline him, and I think things didn't work out well. And when Makerere University was inaugurated as a national university in 1970, on 8th October 1970, we expected to see Idi Amin among the dignitaries. Unfortunately, he was not among those who were officially supposed to be there on the official list. But to our amazement, halfway through the ceremony, Idi Amin turns up in an open jeep, driving himself with his arm attire. And as young students, we had heard these rumors from the grapevine. We cheered him. We thought, this is a man who is defying establishment, who is defying authority. And so he came in. Little did we know that the following year would be the one sitting in the chancellor's seat and dishing out degrees. And so in 1971, January 25th, I remember very well, we during the night we heard some gunshots. We used to call it popcorn. So some people suspected that something was happening. And throughout the day of January 25th, it was the radio, and at that time we had only one radio station, Radio Uganda, which was a government radio. They were playing just martial music. And it was late in the afternoon, maybe about 3, that Idi Amin came on air. And he said, brothers and sisters, there's been a change of government. And then he gave all sorts of a litany of reasons why the army had to intervene and that they had come to rescue the situation. And of course, Milton Obote, the president, had become a little bit unpopular. Some decisions he had taken had made him a little unpopular. And so people cheered. We thought this was the liberation, the coming of the Messiah. Little did we know that we're in for something terrible, really terrible. And but I, for one, had seen military coups in Africa as a young man, and I'd seen the mess they had caused all over. And I told one young lady, she was doing engineering. At that time, that was the first time Makerere was offering engineering, because we had broken away from the Federal University of East Africa. Engineering used to be at the University College in Nairobi, which was part of the Federal University of East Africa. So when the university, the three university colleges became independent universities, we had to start engineering. And this lady was a first-year civil engineering student. And we met because we used to share some courses, science and engineering. And I told her that I hope this is not a military coup, because I'd rather have a rotten civilian government and a so-called clean and angelical military government. And I think I was proved right over the years.
Yeah, indeed. I think that I read a very short quote in one of the articles that I read about you, when you said that you thought that, as far as the university was concerned, that coup, when Idi Amin took over, was the beginning of this period of decline for the university. What did that change of government mean specifically for the university?
Probably wouldn't have experienced so rapidly the things that happened had Idi Amin not started behaving erratically. In 70, towards the end of 72, you see, he had a honeymoon, and everybody, there was a lot of euphoria. Mm-hmm. And people were celebrating the change of government. But in 72, towards the end, Idi Amin started showing, I think, his true colors. You know, when he started saying, I spoke to God in a dream, and God told me to expel all the Asians and the Jews and the British and all other imperialists, Europeans, because these are people who are sucking our economy, they are parasites on us, they are preventing you Ugandans from progressing, and so I'm declaring a war on them, and I'm declaring an economic war. The consequence of that was that all the expatriates we had to go. The Asians were the first to be given a deadline of 90 days, and we thought the man was joking. Because a good section of the Asian community, which was mainly from the Indian subcontinent, was a citizen. They were citizens of Uganda. But he said, I don't make a difference. They are just Asians. So we thought he was joking. Then when we realized that he actually executed his directive and he had to leave, then the next thing he said, by 31st December, all British, all Jews, all these other imperialists must leave Uganda. And Makerere University at that time was largely dependent on expatriate professors. So it meant a big exodus of academic staff, senior professors, you name them. Yeah. And there were very few at that time Ugandans who were in senior academic positions. So it meant that the university would either close or they had to devise a way of surviving. And the scheme they came up with, which was, in a way, we thought was a bit silly, but it turned out that it was a very wise decision, was to say, wait a minute, we have all these young men and women who are graduating. Some of them are getting good degrees. We must make sure that we capture all those who have got good degrees, first-class honors or second-class upper division, and we keep them on our books as staff development fellows. So I was one of those who were caught up in this arrangement. After my degree, I had other ideas. I didn't think I would be an academician. My target was on being an analytical chemist in one of the big industries. But they said, no, you are one of those who think you are good. We are going to make sure that we train you to the highest level possible, if only you can stay. But your stay is conditional, that you accept to teach courses to undergrads. Mm-hmm. You may teach first years, second years, third years. And here where we finished our degree program in March. In those days, the academic year used to end in March, and it opened in July. So in July, I was back in the classroom, not as a student, but as a teacher. And I was using my notes, as you can see, as you know, when you're an undergrad, some of the times in their notes, you write lousy notes and so on. But these are the ones we're using to teach. So it meant that all departments suffered in terms of teaching, and even the ongoing research programs had to be abandoned. And that was the nosedive we went into because of this terrible accident. It is because Idi Amin became, I don't know what drove him into this situation, but he became paranoid about foreigners, and he concocted all sorts of stories. But the most bizarre one was to say, last night I had a dream and I was talking to God and God ordered me to do this. Mm. Yeah.
So in addition to losing faculty because Idi Amin decided that all of the non-Africans had to leave the country, what happened to – was there also less money coming from the government that to support things like building buildings or even maintaining the buildings that you had and making sure that you had everything that you need to run a university, particularly things to outfit microscopes and lab equipment and all those things that you have to have in scientific laboratory?
The decision of Idi Amin to expel the Asians and, of course, the other expatriates led to almost instant economic collapse. Mm-hmm. Because in the country, those were the people who were in charge of commerce, in charge of industry. There were a few Ugandans, but not many. And as a consequence of that, of course, then less and less money was coming from government. And as I said earlier on, the university at that time was totally dependent on government for funding. And, of course, the first thing we noticed that were the expendables, the supplies like chemicals and things started becoming a problem. And the other issue was also it was not an official embargo, but I think most countries stopped trading with Uganda. So it is becoming more and more difficult to get supplies, and even from our traditional suppliers, the crown agents and so on. And, of course, all those were demanding instant cash, and cash not in Uganda shillings, but cash in dollars, in these hard currencies. And one of the consequences of Idi Amin's pronouncements was that foreign exchange also dried up. So we could, even if you had a lot of Uganda shillings, you couldn't convert them into dollars because the dollars were not there. Mm-hmm. And so you couldn't buy, you couldn't order for equipment from outside because you didn't have the right currency. Mm-hmm. So that is it was a terrible time.
One of the things I mentioned at the beginning, just when I was talking about your background, the fact that we talked a little bit about the fact that you were an undergraduate there in Macquarie, and then you went off to Ireland to get your PhD in chemistry. And then after that, you came back and continued to teach and also be involved in higher education administration. When you went to do your PhD, was there any thought in your mind that you might not go back, or did you always have this intention that once you got your degree, that you would then go back home?
I've always been, I think, a patriot. It had never dawned on me that I would stay away of Uganda forever. However, I was a realist. I realized that as long as Idi Amin is there, it might be difficult for a person who has just got a PhD fresh from UK to go back. Am I not supposed to be an agent of British imperialism? Am I going back to spy on behalf of the British government? And all those thoughts came to my mind. And I, of course, one had to be cautious. When I finished, I did a PhD in 3 years. And when I finished, I had to decide what to do. And fortunately, a postdoctoral opening came up in the very department I was a student in. And so I was hired. as a postdoctoral fellow for 2 years. During the 2 years, I was trying to figure out what I should do. I applied for jobs, teaching positions at the University of British Columbia here in Vancouver, and I'd been offered a position as, again, a postdoctoral fellow. I'd been offered 3 positions in Nigeria to teach. But when all those offers were coming my way, also Idi Amin was being shown the exit by the Tanzanians combined with some Ugandans who took it upon themselves to clean up the mess in our country. So when I completed my 2 years as a postdoctoral fellow, that was just the time for me to go back and participate in the rebuilding of the nation. Once again, we're in euphoria. But of course, our euphoria was short-lived again.
Well, that was one of the questions that I wanted to ask next about the fact that, indeed, as you say, in 1979, Idi Amin was forced out. And shortly thereafter, not very long thereafter, Mr. Obote came back. Yeah. Did things, when he was once again running the government, did things improve for the university?
That was a nightmare.
It was just as bad, or was it even worse?
It's just as bad.
Just as bad.
Yeah. Okay, the killings and the things, those had subsided. But then a guerrilla war first ensued. And then Obote, like Idi Amin, became suspect of everybody. And then we began to see a repeat of people disappearing without trace. There was a time when they massacred most of our physicians and dentists. I don't know why they went for them in big numbers, but so everybody was scared. Those who had come back started packing their bags again to coming back to their countries of exile. And it was a difficult one. But what some of us did was to keep a low profile. And we said, let's concentrate on the things that matter. But of course, making ends meet was also extremely difficult. So we had to sacrifice a lot of our academic, what we would call our academic responsibilities, like doing research, supervising students, to moonlight, to go. Some of us were even teaching in high schools just to make ends meet and doing all sorts of things. People were running little kiosks to sell biscuits, to sell sweets and so on. You know, it was a pathetic situation. But as long as you were not seen to be a threat, and of course you had to be very careful because the spies were too many also. And there were people also who wanted to settle all scores. So somebody would say, oh, so-and-so is, I think, part of the guerrilla group. And that was enough to make you disappear forever.
Yeah. I'm sure in a lot of places around the world, universities, colleges and universities would be places of political activism, political action and organizing in opposition to whatever government there was. And you've just pointed out the fact that it was deadly to be an opponent of the government, either of these governments. Mm. Was there political activism, activity, organizing at the university?
A lot of it. I'll give you an example. In 1972, when Idi Amin decided to expel the Asians, some of them who were citizens of Uganda, of course, we students, and then at that time I'd just completed my first year, I was in the second year, we organized a demonstration against all odds. And we marched to what now we call the Constitutional Square, like the quad here. Mm-hmm. And we had a student leader, the leader of our union. He's now the governor of the Central Bank of Uganda. He stood up and said, Mr. President, if you are listening, this thing of stripping people of their citizenship is not on, is not acceptable. Citizenship is not at the whim of a head of state. Once one is a citizen, that's it. And of course they came. And at that time, they had not become too violent. But of course we tested the water cannons and tear gas cannons to disperse us. That was one example. Then the second example was towards the end. I had just finished my degree in 73, 74. There's again a student union leader who's now the UN Assistant Secretary and the Ambassador for the Children, Mr. Rarotonu. He was the president, and the Minister of Education, Idi Amin's Minister of Education, came to the university to address the students in the auditorium. And this young man said, "Mr. Minister, we have a lot of grievances, and we want you to know that they are serious grievances. First of all, we don't have professors. Second, and because the professors have left because of the mess of your government." These were daring young men. Rarotonu, when I see him nowadays, I really admire him for his guts. These are not acceptable. We cannot allow, you've just expelled Asians and so on. The Brigadier Kiri, who was the Minister of Education, was a fairly cool-headed person, but he went back and reported to his boss. And of course, the Rarotonu, like Mr. Tumsime Mutebile, the one who led us to City Square, they had to get out of the country quick. Mm-hmm. And Rarotonu came up. He was a law student. He completed his law degree at Harvard. And Mutebile, these were brilliant students, completed his bachelor's degree in economics at Oxford. So in a way, getting out of Uganda to save their skins, it was a blessing in disguise for them because they went to some of the best schools in the world to complete their undergraduate degrees. So that was... Then in 76, there was an outright rebellion at Makerere. I forget what sparked it off, but I know. Idi Amin had killed a Kenyan student. In fact, that was the end of Kenyan students coming to Makerere in large numbers until recently. And he had also killed the warden of one of the hostels the students' hostels for girls. The lady was pregnant, and the body was found mutilated on a bridge somewhere in the north of Kampala. So the students went on the rampage. The army, Idi Amin sent in the army. They raped the girls. They made sure they tortured the boys. Boys were told to walk on knees for almost a kilometer on rough roads. And it is one member of staff in my department, the chemistry department, who had nothing to do with the students rioting, happened to be at the wrong place at that time. And he was hit hard, and he lost an eye. And he unfortunately passed away a few years ago. But he had become one-eyed as a result of that 1976 rebellion. So Makerere has always been a seat of resistance. And as you rightly said, universities are like that. They are always anti-establishment. They are, if they are friends to you today, be sure tomorrow they will be on the other side. So it's a very interesting group of people.
We are a bit past the midpoint here, and I should again introduce our guest for anyone who has tuned in the last 20 minutes or so. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Dr. John Sifubu, and he was from 1993 until this past March, the Vice Chancellor of Makerere University, which is the largest, most prestigious institution of higher education in Uganda that's been there for more than 80 years. He was educated there as an undergraduate, got a PhD in chemistry at Queen's University in Belfast, and went back and worked both as a teacher and a higher education administrator there at Makerere, where he was an undergraduate. He is here visiting this campus to give the 14th Annual Mortenson Distinguished Lecture. This is a visit here sponsored by the Mortenson Center for International Library Programs. He'll be talking about his experiences as Vice Chancellor of Makerere this afternoon at 4 o'clock at Room 126, the Graduate School of Library and Information Science. And, of course, if people are interested in attending, they should feel welcome. Also, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I just must ask you about a story also that I read about an event that took place, I think this was last fall, just to illustrate the fact that maybe students haven't changed very much, although maybe the thing that gets them upset does change. There was a riot among students, and there were troops called out. There were some shots fired. And in this particular case, I think the students were rioting because they hadn't gotten their support payments from the government. This was last last November, I think, during the time that you were still the chancellor of the university. What was that about?
When the government of Uganda still sponsors a sizable section of the students at Makerere, they're supposed to get full bursaries or full scholarships, which includes tuition, boarding fees, and a few other things. Normally, we don't have enough space for all of them in the halls of residence on the university campus. So many of them are forced to seek for their own accommodation. But they expect to get a stipend from government to cover their expenses. And so this time around, we had noticed abuses that some students were becoming a bit crafty. They would claim that they are not residents in these university residences, and at the same time they were. So they were getting this stipend and at the same time staying in the university. So the finance office of the university said, no, we must clean up this act. And to do so, let's now move away from the manual system to a fully computerized system, which we think the students can't beat. But of course, we had to develop the software to be able to manage that system. And in the process, the money, we couldn't dispatch the checks in time. And of course, the students started agitating. They became jittery, and they said, "Our money, these administrators are busy stealing our money," and so on. That's always the easiest accusation to drum up support for a cause. And so they started. Unfortunately, when they did it, a good part of the checks had gone to their banks. But they patronized one particular bank. It's called Posta Bank. It's owned by the Post Office of Uganda. This bank doesn't charge a big commission on a check, in cashing checks. So every students don't want to lose money. So when the checks, these large number of checks were sent to this bank, I think the bank management was overwhelmed. And so when the students went to find out whether the checks were there, The bank management said, no, Makerere has not dispatched checks here yet, when actually even they had signed the delivery book. So because they knew if they said, yes, we have, then the students would go into pandemonium in the bank. And so to avoid that, they threw the thing back to us. And of course, the students came back and said, "You are liars." So it was also the day when the new chancellor of the university was being installed, who's the non-head of state, because now we have a new law which does not allow the head of state to be chancellor of any public university in Uganda. So it was quite, but we had managed to control some of the rioting students. But then those who wanted to prove to the new chancellor that is coming into a place which is not as friendly as he thought, because he had been a professor there before and he knew. So when he was installed, they said this was a baptism of fire. So that's why
that's quite a set of circumstances coming together to make those events. I appreciate having some of the background just about how it is that happened. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with a caller. We have someone here in Urbana that would like to talk with you on our line number one, right here. Hello.
Good morning. Aside from the financial problem that you just described, could you go into some detail on the status of your university today, number of students, percentage of women students, percentage of faculty that come from outside Uganda, and I'll hang up and listen.
Very good.
Thank you very much. Actually, I was coming to that.
I'm glad the caller raised the question.
Thank you for that question. Of course, the road to recovery has been long and difficult. But as I speak now, Makerere University is back, almost back where it was, and it is even modernized thanks to the many friends we've had, and I think thanks to the effort of some of us, the people have worked very, very hard. Currently, we have a student population of 32,000, and of those, 44% are girls. As far as the faculty is concerned, and we are close to 2,000 faculty, from assistant professors right up to full professors, I think almost 99% are Ugandans. We get a few expatriate faculty, mainly from here and from other countries, but these are sponsored by organizations like the Fulbright Commission here. We also have linkages, collaborative linkages with several universities here in the USA and in Europe. So people come for short stints. They come and teach or come and do some research work with some of the colleagues at Makerere. But I'm proud to say that as I speak now, we've really Ugandanized the faculty at Makerere, so much so that at some levels now we are saturated, although at the higher levels it is still difficult to recruit good people. Our salaries are still not the best, but they are not the worst either. But we're still working very hard on improving the salaries. At least that's one of the responsibilities my successor has to undertake, to make sure that we can recruit and retain good, high-caliber academic staff. Otherwise, the university is now in good shape. If you have to come and see, and if you had the time, you should come and listen to this lecture I'm giving this afternoon, because I have a video clip which I'll be showing, which shows the stages the university has gone through.
Hmm. Of the 32,000 students, roughly speaking, how many of those are come from outside of Uganda?
The last count, I think it was 2% of those. It's still a small fraction. Our biggest catchment area is Kenya. Kenyans, for some reasons now, like Ugandan education. We get a few from Tanzania, and especially exchange arrangement. A few from Rwanda, because now Rwanda is more English than French, as for reasons which some people know. We get also students who come to take credits from universities in Norway, in Japan, and we have also a group of students from Harvard who come every year to one of our biological research stations, which is some 200 kilometers west of Makerere, west of Kampala. They have a very, very interesting program there on primates and the ecology of the primates, mainly the chimpanzees, the monkeys, particularly these black and white monkeys, what they call the colobus monkeys. And then, of course, the interaction between the people and these primates, because farmers look at these animals as really a nuisance. They are vermins because they raid their crops and so on. It's a program which has been ongoing for a number of years. Mm. And financially, we now generate most of our revenue from fees and from other services we provide, which is something which is totally new. And as I speak now, the government subvention is almost 49 or 48%. Now we've surpassed what we get from the Treasury. We and that does not include even for the funds we get from the big donors like the Rockefeller Foundation, like NORAD, like SIDA of Sweden, and so on. Mm.
One of the things I read, there was a story that about the some of the comments that you made at the graduation ceremony in March, this past March, and this was also the time when you were handing over the leadership of the university to your successor. You said something to the fact that you thought that that the priority of the university had to be science, had to be the sciences, and that's not to say that liberal arts aren't an important, but that you seem to be saying that particularly for the development of the country, it was very important that the priority, sort of the key, that the thing was educating people in science.
That's right, and for good reason. Of course, I must confess that probably being a scientist myself, that naturally people would expect me to say that. But it's nothing to do with my background in science. It is now a national policy that we should put a lot of emphasis on science. And we know the benefits of science as far as the development process is concerned. I talked about the quality of agriculture. All the varieties of crops now we grow, and these have not come from nature, but these are coming out of our laboratories. And we know the quality they have given us, and in terms of your food value, and also in terms of the export market. We know what health has done. We know what the health sciences, the medical sciences have done in controlling the HIV/AIDS pandemic, which was a terrible thing, and I will be talking about this this afternoon. We know how much the engineering part contributes to the infrastructure. We are now attracting a lot of modern communication companies who need good electrical engineers, people who have specialized in light currents and so on. We are now battling with the problem of power because of the power shortage. We don't generate enough. We get a lot of power outage. It's a load shedding. Power is rationed. And so we need a lot of power engineers as we develop more of our hydroelectric stations. It's from that point of view that we are putting a lot of emphasis on science. And secondly, I think, I don't know why, but in our part of the world, many students tend to shun away from science under the pretext that science is, first of all, hard. But then the rewards, when you go out for employment, the rewards are not commensurate with the hard work you put in. Mm-hmm. They see their colleagues who have done economics, who have done management, who have done law, earning big money. And as my children sometimes say, obscene salaries. And here you have the engineers, the physicists, who are almost earning peanuts. And the pittance these people earn is discouraging many of young men and women from science. And it's the detriment of science. We are lacking now mathematics teachers because people are not willing to invest in that discipline. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, all get almost in next to nothing. So that's why we are putting emphasis on that.
Yeah. We're down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes. But one thing I thought I might ask you, and again, perhaps it's because your visit here is sponsored by the Mortensen Center, and their interest is helping librarians from around the world to improve the operation of their libraries. One of the things that I know that has happened at Macquarie during the time that you were there is an effort to try to get computers into the university, to have it more computerized, the library particularly, and to get people hooked up to the internet. What has that meant for the university?
It is actually a mini revolution. To begin with, because of we now have substantial reserves of dollars, foreign exchange, but still buying hard copies of textbooks and other materials is still expensive. Now, by hooking onto the internet, now we are subscribing to over 8,000 electronic journals. And therefore, anybody doing research at Macquarie now has no excuse of quoting as the latest reference, which is 3 years old. It's almost instantaneous. So this is a big breakthrough in as far as the library resources are concerned. Secondly, for the students, instead of going for textbooks and hardcover, the members of staff just search the internet and they tell them to go to a certain website and get material, and they get good material out of that, and they can download, and they can get hard copies, or they can take electronic versions of these things. So the resource, this enormous resource which the internet, the information superhighway opened, is unbelievable. It is a blessing. You see, it's like the cellular phone, because many people have been saying, how do you get people in Africa, as many people in Africa, on the telephone line? And at that time, we're talking about the copper wires, right, and so on. Yeah. How do you get them into the remotest part of rural Uganda, rural Kenya, rural Congo, rural... Suddenly, the cellular phone came on the scene. And all they need, the networks need, is just to make sure that their repeaters are all over the place. And they, see they use solar power for generating. Similarly, for universities, the internet, at least if, particularly for African universities, the internet is really a big blessing in disguise that we have resources. And, of course, we continue to subscribe to the traditional resources. But that means that we are even paying less, because it's far much cheaper to get materials this way. Like those journals, we pay almost close to nothing. Of course, we have friends who help us to subscribe and to subsidize the prices. But even if we're paying, we are now preparing, we have a fund, so that even when the donor support dries up, we have our own fund to continue.
Well, I think we're about at the point where we're going to have to finish, because we're here near the end of our allotted time for this first hour of Focus 580. I would mention once again, for people who are on the campus in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Dr. John Sufubu, talking about his experiences as the Vice Chancellor of Makerere University in Uganda. He'll be giving the 14th Annual Mortensen Distinguished Lecture, talking about his experiences, today, 4 o'clock this afternoon, in room 126 of the Graduate School of Library and Information Science on the U of I campus. And I am certain that anyone who is interested in hearing him should feel welcome to stop by. He was the Vice Chancellor of Makerere, the leading university in Uganda from 1993 until just this past March. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. The program also made possible by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Classes are ongoing. Individuals may join anytime. For more information, call 384-5829 or visit their website at www.livingyogacenter.net. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, you'll be hearing about the Disease Detection Corps of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Over the last half century, this corps of doctors has helped eradicate smallpox, push back polio, and solve the first major outbreaks of Legionnaire's disease and toxic shock syndrome. More recently, they have assisted in hunting down SARS and also have investigated the anthrax attacks of 2001. Journalist Maren McKenna will be talking with host Celeste Quinn following the 1 o'clock News. She's a science and medical writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and is the author of a recently published book titled Beating Back the Devil. That's part of the Afternoon Magazine. The show itself gets underway at noon with the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other things, and then the interview is in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. Celeste Quinn is the host for the program. Coming up in the next part of this show, we'll be talking a little bit about preserving family history through telling stories, and we will have two guests with us, both of them people who are very interested in literature for children and have published books for children, Janice Harrington, who works over at the Champaign Public Library, and Betsy Hearn, who is professor of library science in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at the U of I. And we'll be talking a little bit about books that they have written and also this whole area of stories, family stories. That'll be in the next part of the show, so hope you'll stick around. We'll have some news for you at 1 minute past the hour. First, though, an update on the market, so please stay tuned.
And with this update on the markets, coming up on 10:59, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. Well, we're seeing some setbacks on the Chicago Board of Trade from yesterday's gains. December wheat now down 1.5 at 314.5. March at 326, down 3/4. December corn 205, down 1/4. March at 215.5, unchanged right now. What just changed to 215.25, down 1/4. May corn at 223.25 unchanged, and July at 229.5 currently unchanged. November soybeans 537.75.